Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments today on how Ohio maintains its voter rolls. Registered voters who do not vote for 2 years are marked and sent notices by mail. If the registered voter neither responds nor votes for two more federal election cycles, his or her name is removed from the rolls. Secretary of State John Husted told WOSU Steve Brown that sometimes even that process falls short.
In some counties in Ohio, even after all of these efforts to reach voters, we still have some counties that have had more voters on the voter rolls than they've had people living in the county. So it's clear that we need to take proactive efforts to make sure that the voter rolls are up to date. And we do that in Ohio all the time. And frankly, it's never been easier to register to vote in Ohio.
Opponents of the voter purges say that the practice violates federal law and amounts to a form of voter suppression. A federal appeals court agreed, and now the question is before the nation's highest court. Coming up, we'll hear from interested parties on both sides. Joining us now is correspondent for the Associated Press, Julie Carr-Smythe. Welcome back.
Hi, Ann.
The state has been using the practice since 1994. That's an argument that Secretary of State Husted puts forth repeatedly. Why the lawsuit now?
Well, the reason he puts that forth is because right now there is this partisan furor, if you will, about voting and voting access. We're a very divided nation right now in a way that we weren't in 1994, and Ohio does have a notably bipartisan election system. So the reason the state brings that up is that both Republican and Democratic secretaries of state through the decades have enforced some kind of a law for keeping order in our roles. What's different now is partly this partisan divide and partly that under a consent decree a couple years ago in another lawsuit, Husted's office had to increase the amount of times that it sent out these notices. One could argue, and they do on the Republican side, that that gives people more opportunity to avoid being purged. On the Democratic side, they argue, or on the advocacy side, they argue that, in fact, that means that you have more chances to kind of mess up and think this is junk mail, toss it aside. And so, in other words, if you're on the side of you should never have to go through a hurdle or a hoop to be able to vote, it's more hurdles and hoops.
The plaintiffs have said that it amounts to voter suppression. Can you explain how that works and why they say that?
Well, if you think about it, and I had an example in my own life the other day. So I got a letter. Actually, my daughter and I both got letters from some entity where we're members or have an account or something. And it was a big, fat packet, very intimidating. And it said something like, if nothing about your life has changed, you need not do anything. I think that's what most consumers assume. Even when you get your open enrollment and your insurance, people can make mistakes because they think, well, I'm planning to leave it just as it is. So I'm going to toss that in the trash. I have a busy life. I don't really want to have to make a proactive hoop. So that is why the advocates in this case are saying you've put an obstacle in front of a voter, a very busy voter, some people who don't even look at their snail mail at all anymore. And now you're sending them these postcards to affirm something they think is already set. I had interviewed someone in an article for an earlier article on the case who said, you know, listen, I registered when I was 18. In my view, I should be able to simply go back to the polls whenever I want to. Now, Ohio's never done it that way, but that would be the purest argument for minimal obstacles to voting.
A lower court, well, when the lawsuit went forward, a lower court agreed with the state, sided with the state, an appeals court sided with the plaintiffs. What was the difference in their decisions?
What I think is that the civil rights side of this is that and usually the higher courts, the higher you go up the chain, the more they side in favor of sort of a civil rights argument. Lower down, the court said that, you know, the paperwork requirement is not oppressive. I'm not thinking of the right word, but and that basically it is it is legal what's being done, it's transparent, and there's no reason why it shouldn't be allowed because Ohio has a justification for keeping its rolls clean.
Right. And by the way, I mean, Ohio is following the letter of the law. It's not like it's doing something. It's not like it's not doing its job. It's the law itself that's in question here.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And as we said, it's been in place since 1994. I think that a default position most people think is as long as I vote in federal elections, I'm going to remain registered.
Right.
I don't have to worry with all these in-between elections. And so as you add a two-year postcard and then you add a one-year postcard that's requiring people to think about elections, many of whom don't think about elections at all in between, that's part of the issue.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. The U.S. Supreme Court hears a case involving Ohio today and how Ohio Secretary of State's office maintains its voter rolls. There is a requirement that the Secretary of State's office maintain those rolls and update them and make sure that they're accurate. But there's another issue as far as how you do that, and it's the process by which they do that is in question in the Supreme Court today. If you have a question or comment, my guest is Julie Carr-Smyth. She's a correspondent for the Associated Press. She covers this issue. Coming up, we'll also hear from different sides of the issue, and you can ask your question then. The number is 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Other states maintain their rolls like Ohio. How many would be affected by this decision? I guess that's part of what goes into the decision to take on the case at the highest level anyway.
Right. I can't recall the exact number, but it's most definitely a seminal case that people believe is going to have an effect across the country.
Okay.
The reason being that if the court says, yes, it's okay to, you know, in the minds of those who brought the lawsuit, put up an obstacle, a burden on the voter to have to proactively affirm their voting habits. This is for people who haven't moved, haven't done anything wrong, you know, then that is going to be something that other states can turn to and say, well, it's okay if we do something like mm-hmm. that. If the plaintiff should win, the idea would be, oh, you can't ask someone to have to affirm something that they already believe that they believe has never expired and has never changed. They're sitting in their house. They're living in the same place. They voted a while ago, maybe a year, two, three mm-hmm. ago. There hasn't been a subsequent federal election. Two federal elections. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't have to worry. And one big issue that I found fascinating in this is that, speaking of federal elections, there was a huge cohort of American voters this last time who were abstaining from voting in the presidential election on principle. So what about the voters' right to abstain on principle, to say, I don't like Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. I don't find either of these candidates for the major parties appealing. I am protesting mm-hmm. by not voting. And as secretaries of state and election officials have always had an issue with this, because what they try to do in terms of record keeping is they try to measure an overvote and an undervote. And an overvote would be, oh, we have more people voting for an issue than there were registered people. An undervote would be, we have fewer people voting than were registered. So you can see where that's just maddening to an election official, because they're trying to keep track and make sure everything is without fraud. So what happens when voters say, I just want to use that as a form of protest to say that I don't like either candidate?
We have an email from Booth, who writes, there needs to be some way to clean up the voter registration rolls. I know for a fact that when each of my children moved out of the house and out of the country, their names remained on the rolls for many years, even though I know they were registered to vote elsewhere, in two cases out of state and two cases elsewhere in Ohio. They could easily have voted at least twice, once at home and once by absentee ballot in the old polling precinct. I'm sure they didn't, but voter fraud could have occurred, and at least for the out-of-staters, would have been essentially undetectable.
That's absolutely true. And I know when I worked at the Plain Dealer, we had done some work and did find many duplicate voters. For example, in Florida, where, you know, a state like Ohio has many people who spend part of the year in each place. Mm-hmm. So it is possible that
you're not allowed to vote in each place.
Right. Yeah. Right. The thing is that you have to keep track of the difference between being registered, perhaps appearing on rolls in two places, and actually voting in two places.
Yeah.
John Husted himself, who's a Republican, he has done extensive work on this question of voter fraud, and he has been able to find very few cases of legitimate voter fraud.
Meaning it was intentional.
Right. Meaning that because we see a lot with registrations, people say, oh, Mickey Mouse registered or Donald Duck registered. And this comes with groups of outside advocates who are paying people for how many people they can register. So that became an issue with, oh, you're registering fraudulent names and people. Mm-hmm. That does not translate, one, into Mickey Mouse getting on the rolls at all, nor does Mickey Mouse vote. So you have to really keep track of your children may have been registered in two places, but that the system very well and probably would have caught it if they had voted twice.
As you said, even John Husted said that the incidents of actual fraud are extremely rare.
Right. And to your other question about why now, in the interim between 94 and now, as we all know, the world has gone online. And there's a much higher expectation, I think, of databases like this being clean and being accurate in a way that 25 years ago we wouldn't have expected. I've been doing a little work on genealogy, and I realized that, you know, my old handwritten notes with scrawled things in the margins from 25 years ago are just antiquated. And, you know, there are ways to make everything clean and nice and neat. And that's what people want from the voting system now.
Secretary of State John Husted has said that this should not be a problem anyways, because it's never been easier to register to vote. Is that a defense?
I guess
you could just go re-register. What's the problem?
Right. In my mind, I don't think that that is a fair point in this particular case, because if you get to the polls and you don't know that you've been taken off the rolls, you know, yes, you can vote provisionally. That will be counted. You'll be held in reserve and hopefully re-registered for the next time. But one voter I talked to for an article said, you know, they were told when they came in they weren't registered. They voted provisionally, and their board, right or wrong, told them this provisional vote will be checked, and as long as it's accurate, that will serve to register you again. Then they went back the next time, and they weren't registered. So it's a lot of clerical confusion around whether you are or aren't registered. And obviously, as easy as it may be, if you're not aware that you're not registered, you're not going to use those means to become registered.
The safest bet is to vote. Just saying that, people. But that you cannot compel somebody to vote in our system.
That's right. I mean,
and there's this is sort of a form of compulsion in a way. If you don't answer those notes in the mail and you don't vote, you lose your right to vote.
Right. Interestingly, in other countries, there is compulsion.
Right.
You know, Election Day is a national holiday. You have to show up and register, like we have to pay our taxes here in this country. It's part of your civic duty and your civic obligation. Mm-hmm. So you're right. It is a form of that. I mean, nobody's saying you have to vote, but somebody is saying you have to read your mail and you have to return a postcard. You know, it depends on who you are, whether you feel like that's a minor thing to have to do or whether you think that that's a hurdle.
Julie Carr-Smyth, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Julie Carr-Smith is a correspondent for the Associated Press. She's been covering this issue in Ohio. It's the issue of how Ohio cleans up its voter rolls. The question is before the United States Supreme Court today. We're going to hear from different points of view on this now, so stay with us. And if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The U.S. Supreme Court today hears the case of Husted versus A. Philip Randolph Institute. That's Husted as an Ohio Secretary of State, John Husted, and he is arguing in support of how the state maintains its voter rolls and how it has maintained its rolls since 1994. Last spring, when the nation's highest court decided to take up the question, Husted defended the practice to the public.
If you don't vote for 2 years, we send you out a postcard and attempt to connect you to see if you still want to be registered to vote and to vote at the address that you're registered at. If you do not respond and then you don't vote for another 4 years, so a total of 6 total years, then we remove you from the voter rolls. That's what the Ohio law says. That's what the federal law says.
Critics say that the practice amounts to voter suppression and violates federal law. Joining us is Ohio State Professor Daniel Tokaji, who is working with the ACLU of Ohio on the case. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
And by phone is Assistant General Counsel at the Landmark Legal Foundation, a conservative legal advocacy group that has issued a brief in support of the state, Mike O'Neill. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Mike, John Husted has repeatedly defended the process by saying that it is more than 20 years old and has been embraced by both Democrat and Republican administrations over the years. Does longevity make a difference?
Well, it does. And first of all, there's an identified problem here. In our country, we have the Pew Research Foundation found that 2.75 million people have registrations in more than one state. Another study that was conducted showed that there were 141 counties in 21 states have more registered voters than residents. So we have an identified problem here. We have a mobile society. Individuals move from state to state, from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And so what we have here is you have registrars, election officials in effect, are tasked with competing with two competing interests. Number one, they have to ensure that eligible citizens who are registered to vote are registered to vote and to increase that number. And number two, they also have to protect the integrity of the election process and to ensure that their state and their jurisdictions maintain accurate and up-to-date voter rolls. Mm-hmm. In other words, they have to make sure that people who are registered in their jurisdiction or who are registered in Ohio aren't also registered in another state, such as Florida, or who are registered in counties aren't registered in another county. So you have a balance that they need to strike. And what, of course, has occurred is that there needs to be some list maintenance processes that need to be implemented.
Right.
Now, of course... Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say the Census Bureau shows that about 3% of people in Ohio move across county lines each year. More than half of Ohio voters, sadly, typically do not cast a ballot in federal midterm elections. When the state targets those non-voters with the mailings, 8 out of 10 never respond. Why the supposition that they have moved? Obviously, the census is telling us one thing and the response on those cards is telling us another thing. Is this the best way to achieve the goals that you've stated?
Well, it's certainly the best way that's been identified so far. I mean, is there a perfect system? Of course not. But this has been again, you have to achieve this balance. And this is what the state of Ohio and the state legislature have decided to utilize. That now what exactly are you looking at the individual? What exactly is the obligation you're placing on the individual? Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, let's talk about the process and let's break it down so that everybody's clear exactly what happens.
Well,
you don't
Okay.
Go ahead.
I mean, we have done that several times now throughout the program. We know that if you don't vote for 2 years, you get tagged, you get sent mail. If you get sent mail every year now because of the consent decree to remind you or to get you to respond. And, you know, Dan Tokaji, I mean, what's the burden of that?
you have to look at this like any other voting issue, Ann, in systemic terms. And here's the reality. There is a big problem here, but it's not the one that Mike identifies. The big problem is that in Ohio, thousands of eligible voters are purged from the rolls in each election cycle for no reason other than they're not having voted in the past.
So by these purges, they're not getting it right, is what you're saying. It's not the intent is not achieving its goal. That's people who should be able to vote are not able to vote because of this.
Yeah, exactly right, Anne. And no one is saying that you can't remove someone for the rolls for any reason at all. In fact, if the state's goal is to remove people who have moved, as it claims, there are much better ways of doing that than using not voting as a proxy. And I'm happy to go through those with you.
Well, I asked Michael that, and he said this is considered the best way. You
disagree? By no one. It is not considered the best way by anyone, including the state of Ohio. And actually, Ohio, he mentioned people who are registered in Ohio and other states. Well, Ohio actually participates in a program where it shares information with other states. There's no bar on their using information from that program to initiate the removal process, to send out the postcard that Secretary Hust had mentioned. There's no bar on the state of Ohio using returned mail that's been sent by a board of elections to a voter and has come back, returned as undeliverable, as a basis for initiating the removal process by sending out the postcard. And finally, there's no bar on using information from the United States Post Office, as Ohio already does, to identify people who may have moved. What
those
the state can't
records.
Do.
Those are all open records.
Well, there's a program, the National Change of Address Program, through which, under the National Voter Registration Act, states can get that information. The one thing the state can't do, and what Ohio is doing, is to use the failure to vote as a basis for initiating the removal process. That's not a good indicator of who's moved and who hasn't, for exactly the reason that you mentioned earlier. There are a lot of people who vote only in presidential elections. And under the Secretary of State's policy, if you are one of those people and you miss one presidential election and then, you know, you get set the mailing or maybe you don't, maybe the mail isn't delivered, you can be purged from the rolls. And thousands of people have been purged from the rolls.
Well, let's. Can I
ahead,
interject?
Mike. Yeah, sure, Mike O'Neill. Yep.
Well, first of all, let's look at this. It is the reason why you have been removed. Well, the reason why you have been removed from the voter rolls is not because you have not voted. It's because you have not responded to a postage prepaid postcard sent to you into the mail that says date and sign this card to confirm your residency, and then 4 years elapse. Then you are removed from the voter rolls. So the actual cause of removal from the voting from your voter rolls is not from non-voting, which everybody can agree that is prohibited, but it's not from non-voting. It's from not responding to a notice sent to you by your state or by your registrar.
But it's triggered by non-voting.
Well, it is, but again, there is an intervening action here, and then you have to understand that that there is a minimal effort that is expected from the citizen. Look, we live in a country that bestows upon us incredible blessings and incredible gifts. And is it really too much to ask that for you to sign and date a card to ensure that we have fair, open, and honest elections? Look, there's an identified problem here. There's millions of people who appear on multiple state voter that are registered to vote in multiple states. This is a supplemental process that the Secretary of State has used. The professor mentioned the National Change of Address process. Mm-hmm. That is used by Ohio.
Yeah.
This is a supplemental process to ensure that there are accurate and up-to-date voter rolls. And again, this is an obligation that the federal government places on states, that they take reasonable efforts to make sure that their voter rolls are accurate and up-to-date.
Why aren't
now, filling out a card under – go ahead.
Well, why aren't those processes enough? Why aren't comparing and cross-referencing – you know, the voter rolls in other states, the returned mail from the U.S. Postal Service and the other things that Dan Tokaji just mentioned. Why isn't that enough?
Well, it's a great start, but certainly there still exists a problem because even though that these processes do exist, again, you still have these incidences where counties have more individuals on their registration rolls that are present in the county that are census designated in the county. You have studies conducted by Pew that say, hey, 2.75 million people have duplicate registrations. So what are states going to do? What can counties and localities do? They need to have additional tools to ensure that their voter rolls are accurate and up to date, and that so that we can all have confidence in the election process.
Michael O'Neill from Landmark Legal Foundation, it comes at the cost of some people, thousands of people, losing the right to vote because they didn't respond to those cards.
Well, again, we have to strike a balance here. The balance, is any system going to be 100% perfect? Are there going to be instances where individuals don't see the mail and fall through the cracks? Yes. However, there is nothing to prevent those individuals from re-registering to vote and then voting subsequently.
Yeah.
Dan Takagi?
Congress struck the balance. Congress, 25 years ago, enacted into law the landmark National Voter Registration Act. Precisely,
is this the motor voter law?
The motor voter laws, it's commonly caused, although that's something of a misnomer because that law, the National Voter Registration Act, doesn't merely require that opportunities for registration be offered at motor vehicle offices and other state offices. It also has restrictions on the removal or purging of people from the voting list. And this was not an imaginary problem either back in 1993 or today. Thousands of people get removed, and the language of the NVRA is actually quite clear. The state shall not implement a program that results in the removal of the name of any person from the official list of voters registered to vote by reason of the person's failure to vote.
But now, there's another subsection.
Well, hold on.
But another subsection allows removal of the voter for failing to vote and failing to reply to a notice directed to him or her.
But if you read the statute carefully, Ann, it's clear that the exception that you're referring to is the post office, the national change of address information exception. That's actually a much better way of identifying people then moved than using non-voting as a proxy for someone's having moved. So everyone agrees that the state can use that information from the postcard as a basis for sending out the postcard, then it initiates the removal process. The state can also get information from other states, as Ohio has started doing in the last couple of years. In fact, Pew and others recognize that that's a much better way of identifying people who have moved than using the failure to vote or the decision not to vote as a proxy for someone having moved.
Yeah, Mike O'Neill?
Well, sure. I'm glad the professor brings up the statute because the statute, as he rightly points out, there's an exception. That nothing in the National Voter Registration Act may be construed to prohibit a state from using the procedures utilized by the state of Ohio to remove an individual from the list of eligible voters.
Well, that state of Ohio part is not, of course, what the statute actually says, as I think Mike would concede.
I concede that. But, of course, the supplemental process which we're discussing conforms and incorporates the exact section of the statute that states and the individual has not voted for 2 years, is received a notice, and then doesn't vote for a subsequent 4 years, may be removed. The state has the authority to remove that individual from its voter rolls. Now, what we're talking about is where do they get that data? Where do they get if there's the initial process, which is the safe harbor provision, which is the national change of address. If the state receives notice from the national change of address database that an individual has moved, it can use that national change of address data to initiate this process.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the statute does not say anything about if you're not voting initially, then you're sent a notice, then you don't vote, then you are removed. So there is an exception in the statute that allows the states to have the authority to enact a program like the supplemental process that we've been talking
Mike,
about.
Mike, what's the magic in 2 years? Most, as we made the point before that typically more than half of Ohio voters do not cast a ballot in a federal midterm election. They just vote every 4 years. They vote for president. That's more typical.
Sure.
Why the scrutiny after 2 years?
To trigger it. Right. For whatever reason, the state decided that that was an operative amount of time. Now, could it be longer? Certainly, it could be longer. But that is the operative amount of time to maximize the returns to trigger the notice being distributed to the individual. And again, let's focus on this. Let's focus on the effort that is to be made. All your jurisdiction, all your state is asking you to do is to sign and date a postage prepaid self-addressed card. All you have to do is sign that card. I'm still a resident here. Drop that card into a mailbox, and then you are on the voter rolls. Is that really too much to ask?
Well, I guess, you know, Dan Takagi, is it too much to ask?
Well, let me give you an example that I think brings this to life. I was at a press conference yesterday with a veteran, someone who served in Iraq and was purged as a result of the practice we've challenged. His name is Joe. He was away serving his country in Iraq. His family has no recollection having received this supposed postcard that the state sent. But when he went to vote back in 2011, he found that he'd been purged from the rolls, apparently through the supplemental process. He'd never filled out any document with the post office, which is everyone concedes that's a permissible way if there's information from the post office indicating your address has changed. But that didn't happen. He was purged for his failure to vote after having served his country in Iraq. And it demonstrates that there are real people, thousands of them, behind these numbers. There are thousands of people who've been purged in Ohio alone. There are really only six other states that do something comparable under their laws to what Ohio is doing. But even if it were 50 states that were doing it, it would still be impermissible because it's a violation of this federal voting rights law, which has now been in effect for 25 years.
And I guess we have no clear evidence that every vote counts. And in some of those, you know, then the coin toss, was that South Carolina or Virginia?
Virginia,
right. I mean, every vote does count. Mike O'Neill, Assistant General Counsel at Landmark Legal Foundation, and Dan Takagi, he's a professor at OSU Moritz College of Law and a cooperating attorney for the ACLU of Ohio, which is a plaintiff in this case. We are going to continue our conversation about how Ohio maintains and updates its voter rolls. So if you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And we'd like to hear from voters or people who have been purged from the voter rolls. If you're listening and you could tell us your story, we would like to hear it. So take the time, and we'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about how Ohio maintains its voter rolls, a process at the heart of a case before the U.S. Supreme Court today. Still with us is OSU Law Professor Daniel Takagi. Professor Takagi is involved in this case as one of the cooperating attorneys for the ACLU of Ohio. And by phone, a lawyer with Landmark Legal Foundation, a conservative legal advocacy group that wrote a brief in support of the state, Michael O'Neill. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Daniel Takagi, why the argument that these purges disproportionately affect low-income voters and voters of color?
Well, as a legal matter, it really doesn't matter, right? Whether the people removed are predominantly people of color or white, whether they're predominantly poor or rich, whether they're predominantly Democrats or Republicans, the removal of voters by virtue of their failure to vote is a violation of federal voting rights law that affects thousands of people. However, there is some evidence, and not surprising evidence at that, that certain groups of people are predominantly affected. Low-income people, people who are, for example, living in a low-rent apartment or homeless shelter, well, I guess it's not terribly surprising that this one postcard that they get before being purged from the rolls, they might not get. And we also have a lot of people, you know, predominantly these days, not the richest people in our society, who are serving in the military if they happen to be on duty overseas when they get the postcard and someone in their household throws it away or something else happens to it, they may be affected as well. So it's not a surprise that less affluent and minority voters are predominantly affected by the purges that Ohio and a few other states are engaging in, as a Reuters study found.
Why do you say one postcard?
Can I drop in really briefly?
Yeah, sure.
Briefly,
go ahead,
here.
Michael Neal.
Let's not gloss over an important fact here. Let's walk through the process again, because we seem to be ignoring an integral component here. You receive this notice, and you don't return the notice. For example, if you're deployed overseas, or if you don't, or for any other reason, 4 years elapse before you're removed from the voting rolls. So you don't. So it's a three-part process here. It's number one, there's no voter activity for 2 years. Number two, you're sent a notice for a confirmation of residency. And again, let's not pretend this is somehow burdensome or unreasonable. It is, you sign a card, you date a card, you drop it in the mailbox. Then 4 years have to elapse before two federal elections, up to 4 years, have to elapse before you're removed from the voter rolls. So if you're deployed to overseas, deployments don't last 4 years. Deployments don't last 3 years. So if you are deployed, you return home, then you engage in a voter activity. Even though you never filled out that card or dropped that card in, you're not purged from the voter roll.
In
so it's
Tukaji,
important to note that there's an additional four-year process before
right.
4 years
and,
time.
And it's more than one postcard, because of they're supposed to send one a year now, aren't they?
Under the interpretation of federal law that Ohio's advancing, all they have to do, in addition to your not having voted in the previous years, send out that one postcard.
Okay.
And then if you don't vote in the next two election cycles, you can be purged from the rolls. And as I listen to Mike, what I'm struck by is the resemblance between the kinds of arguments he's making and the ones we heard 50 years ago in defense of the poll tax, $1.50 poll tax, like the one in Virginia at the time. People said, oh, it's not that burdensome on voters. But the reality is that, as with the poll tax, thousands of people are excluded from voting by virtue of Ohio's purges.
I believe that's unnecessary, Professor. I don't think you need to get into that. I think what we're talking about here is entirely different, and I don't think that's a fair—
Let Mike O'Neill respond to what you just said. Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
Somehow making the allegation that this is somehow akin to a poll tax or any kind of Jim Crow era prohibition or effort for disenfranchisement, I think that's just a low blow. And I think, Professor, that you're better than that. I think the arguments, I don't agree with the arguments, but I think the arguments on the other side of this that the professor's been advocating are better than that. And I don't think we have to resort to such sort of attack.
You're making the same kinds of arguments about the burden on the voter not being so high that people made in defense of the poll tax 50 years ago.
Point has been made. Let's talk to Carl and Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Carl.
Yes, hi, Anne. I wanted to call our attention to something that Mr. O'Neill said a few minutes ago, which I thought was philosophically really interesting. He said, in sort of an aside comment, that the state gives us this gift that we get to vote, this gift from the state. And I think that's really revealing. I think, in fact, we shouldn't view voting as this gift bestowed by the state, but rather as this fundamental right to be protected, at any cost. And so I think that, policy implications aside, I think that's an interesting philosophical claim to make, that, voting is this gift or privilege, when in fact, I prefer to think of it as this fundamental right.
All right.
I appreciate the opportunity to address and clarify my point there. I'm not saying that that voting is a gift. I'm saying that we live in the United States, and the blessings that our country has bestowed upon us, freedom, rule of law, property rights, these are the blessings that are that we and the privilege we have for living in the United States. I am not, let me be clear, and I apologize if I wasn't clear, let me be clear, I'm not in any way saying that the right to vote is somehow a gift that is bestowed upon the state.
Voting isn't a gift, it's a right, and it is a right
exactly.
that is denied to thousands of people by virtue of Ohio's purges.
Carl, thanks a lot for that call. I wanted to ask something, Mike O'Neill, based on what I said kind of in leaving the last segment, that every vote does count. And if it did, and there's other races in Ohio that have come down to one vote. And in fact, 1,234 votes, it's an easy number to remember back during an attorney general race some years ago. But be that as it may, I mean, there's something like, well, several thousand people can be purged from the rolls and unable to vote in an election because of this process who otherwise are eligible to vote. They didn't move. They didn't respond to their postcard, but they are purged because of this process. It can make a difference in an election. Do you disagree with that?
Every vote does matter.
Of course,
every vote matters. And then conversely, individuals can cast votes in multiple states. If the process has failed, and again, it has failed because the Pew Research Foundation found 2.75 million people have registrations in more than one state.
But
if I'm
okay.
registered, no, hold. Let me finish.
Yeah.
There's another side to that. If I cast an absentee ballot in Ohio and I vote in Florida, I voted twice, and I have adversely affected the outcome of both elections.
It cuts both ways.
So there is two sides to this. And again, what we're talking about here is a balance. A balance needs to be struck between two competing interests.
Okay.
Number one, there's the interest for fair, open, okay. fair and accurate elections. And number two, it's to maximize the number of people and ensure that eligible people can vote. Is it going to be a perfect system? Of course not. We live in a democracy. There is no perfect system. However, Ohio has struck this balance, and this
okay.
is the balance that has been struck.
I want to get to some calls. Chris in Westerville,
sure.
you're on the air. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It's not just for military people. My parents are elderly in their 90s. We work very hard to make sure that they don't sign anything that they don't recognize. And I could easily see them not understanding, what's this strange form that we got? I'm not signing my name to this. I'm not sending it back to you. Yeah. And if they're unable to get to the polls because someone is sick or they're not able to drive and no one's available for a couple years, but they want to go back at a certain time after 4 years,
yeah.
6 years, well, or 8 years?
Yeah, well, let's hear from Mike O'Neill on that score. I mean, Chris brings up a really, and it's going to be an increasingly common issue as the baby boomers age.
Mm-hmm. So, again, if things are lost in the mail, the system is one that is designed to have a 4-year time frame that has elapsed. You are sent the notice. If somehow you miss the notice and you're indicating that these notices now are sent on an annual basis, if that notice is missed and then 4 years go by and you engage in no voter activity, then you are removed from the voter rolls. Then yes, there are going to be instances. You can hypothetically state these instances where that individuals who should have been registered were improperly removed from the registration rolls. But again, there's another side to this point. The side is to ensure that you have accurate rolls. And the other side is to ensure that there's an integrity so that people have confidence in the voter system.
Yeah,
duly registered individuals
okay.
say, that's a fraudulent system. I'm not going to vote. There's their case.
And it would be great if I could get a word
yeah.
in here.
You go know, ahead, Dan Takashi.
Technicalities aside, here's the reality. People are being purged from Ohio's voting rolls for not having voted and just getting one postcard that if they don't respond to or if it gets lost in the mail, informs them of those rights. And let's get real. We all know that a lot of these things look like junk mail. It's veterans who are affected. It's elderly people, like the parents of the person who just called in. It is predominantly poor people and racial minorities who are stricken from the rolls as a result of Ohio's illegal purging policy.
I want to take a call from Laura now. Laura, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi. I have a question. I'm from Linden, and I'm one of those people that in the Cary, because of Blackwell and the Cary Bush election, stood in line for 3.5 hours while my friend, who was a Democrat, walked into Worthington and voted.
Uh-huh.
So we all know what's going on, no matter what you guys say. Or
okay, but Laura, let's get to your point because we're running out of time.
Well, I want to know how I can make sure that I have not been purged. I was still in this whole last voting. I want to make sure because no one's going to take me.
Dan Takagi, can you help out? Yeah, what's the process in Ohio?
So I appreciate the question. It is a good idea for people like yourself who are really paying close attention to voting and political issues. You can check in Ohio through your local Board of Elections, and if you have access to the web, there's a website that you can use to do it, whether you're registered to vote. But I think the bigger point is that all of us have to be on guard. We have to be vigorous advocates, not only for our own right to vote, but for everyone's right to vote, especially for people who are poor and vulnerable in this state and in this country.
Okay, thanks to Laura and thanks to Chris. Email from Alex. I have a strange situation. I got a letter from the Franklin County Board of Elections addressed to someone who does not live at my house, confirming a change of address to my place. I don't know who that guy is or what he's up to. I sent a copy and a reply to the board, also copied to the sheriff, informing them that no such person lives here, but I haven't received a response. Okay, same thing.
I will echo Professor Takagi's statement about remaining vigilant, and I think the individual who just submitted that email did exactly what they should have done: notified their Board of Elections and notified their local sheriff that the individual does no longer resides at this address, or they had no other knowledge of whomever this person was. So that person did the exact right thing in that situation.
There's two Facebook comments, one from Carol, who says that a flimsy little postcard is very easy to simply overlook. Voting rights are far too important to be handled with such a weak system. And another one from Brad in the same vein. It seems like a way to conveniently remove poor people who may not diligently open mail from the state of Ohio. In this day and age, Mike O'Neill, are there better ways? Are there ways to bone up this system? Is a card in the mail, particularly given what Chris said about doubts by older people, is this the best way? You said it is the best way, but
people out there who disagree. Is it a reasonable way? I think here the standard is reasonableness. Hmm. And is it unreasonable to believe that you filling out a card, or you not even filling out a card, you signing, dating, and dropping a card in the mail is an unreasonable burden to put on you to ensure that we have accurate, fair, and up-to-date voter registration rolls? I don't think it's unreasonable. I think are there better ways? Could you conceivably, hypothetically, craft better ways? Possibly. However, the question here is whether this is a reasonable obligation for somebody who hasn't voted for 2 years to fill out a notice, this sort of card, and then, again, to not vote for a subsequent, to not engage in any kind of voter activity for a subsequent 4 years. So, okay. Is it reasonable? Certainly.
Okay.
Is it the best way? That's a question I really, hypothetically, could you conceive it? Possibly.
Dan Takagi?
Yeah, let me just emphasize two points. First of all, the standard under the statute is not, or at least not just reasonableness. The statute says you can't generally remove people from the rolls or engage in programs that result in their removal from the rolls except through the post office process that we discussed earlier. The second is, there are just a lot of better ways, and this may be the one point that Mike and I at least to some extent agree on. There are lots of better ways of determining who's moved and who hasn't. You could not only use this information from the post office national change of address system.
Look,
if to refer to something that Mike mentioned earlier, Ohio has information from Florida that somebody's moved to that state. There's no bar on initiating the process based on that information you've received. There are lots of better ways without thousands of people being purged from the rolls who haven't moved simply for their failure vote.
The U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments today on how Ohio maintains its voter rolls. That's what we've been talking about today. You heard just heard from Daniel Tokaji. He's an OSU Moritz College of Law professor and currently a cooperating attorney for the ACLU of Ohio. Daniel Tokaji, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Ann.
And also, Michael O'Neill is an assistant general counsel at the Landmark Legal Foundation, an organization that is in support of the status quo. Michael O'Neill, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Ann. I appreciate it.
And everybody, please vote. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.